Okay, if we can begin. We've got two bills on the agenda this morning, and for members, you know, just remember as we get to the end of the session,
that's a good point.
As things come up, you know, don't think that this will be the last meeting. Obviously, we have Senator Stumpf's capital investment bill probably Wednesday morning, but there was some discussion. His committee will meet tomorrow afternoon. There was some discussion, depending on time, that we might potentially turn it around on the floor if it's not too late, maybe meet tomorrow for that. Otherwise, probably Wednesday morning. We have a couple of other smaller matters that have come to my attention. So just stay tuned in terms of scheduling. But this morning we've got two bills, and we'll start out with Senator Sharon on Senate File 2027. And I don't believe there is not a division report. So, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. You should have a fiscal note for this bill in front of you. Also, we've distributed a series of editorials that have been written simply to inform you of what the general public is communicating to us in regard to this bill. I will very briefly describe the contents of the bill, but because we're in the Finance Committee, I've asked the Department of Health to come and articulate clearly what the contents are of the fiscal note, which is important for this committee to review. So this Senate file objective is to protect Clean Indoor Air Act and to keep our kids safe in relationship to a new product that is coming on the market that is not well researched nor significantly regulated. Our Section 1 of the bill has as its purpose to amend the definition of smoking in the existing Clean Indoor Air Act to include e-cigarette use. And the implications of that is that if enacted, wherever smoking is prohibited, e-cigarette use would also be prohibited. In Section 2 of the bill, the purpose of this section is to prohibit the use of e-cigarettes in public schools by extending the prohibition on tobacco products to include e-cigarettes. Section 3, the purpose of this section is to authorize local units of government to require retailers to obtain a tobacco retailer license in order to sell electronic delivery devices and nicotine delivery products other than e-cigarettes. Products that are FDA approved for use as tobacco cessation products or other medical purposes that are not vaped or smoked are excluded. Section 3 or Section 4, the purpose of this section of the bill is to prohibit self-service of e-cigarettes and nicotine or other nicotine delivery products except in only adult retail establishments. Retailers would be required to keep this product behind the counter with other tobacco products, and they could not be sold on open shelving or open counters next to candy or gum, and they also cannot be sold in vending machines. Section 5 is to prohibit preemption of local ordinances that regulate, in addition to sale of tobacco-related devices. It ensures that local ordinances can be more restrictive than state law, which is true also for the current Tobacco Freedom to Breathe Act. Section 6, the purpose of this section is criminal penalties for selling or furnishing tobacco-related devices or cigarettes to minors. Criminal penalties would also be imposed on minors who possess, purchase, or attempt to purchase e-cigarettes. There is an exception in the bill applying to minors who are assisting with compliance checks or related supervised activities for law enforcement. The definition of tobacco would be amended to be consistent with the definition of tobacco products. There's a new definition of electronic delivery device in this section of the bill. Section 7 of the bill proposes to prohibit sales to minors of nicotine delivery products that are not tobacco or electronic delivery service. And that, in essence, is the principal components of the bill.
Right. Senator Sharon, thank you. Let me just make it clear to members that there was not an intent, or I should say that I did not think there was a need to hear this bill in this committee. There ended up being a fiscal note. I'll ask Mr. Albrecht to comment on that for just a second, a very minor fiscal note. So this is more almost of a procedural stop, and hope members might view it as such. But Mr. Albrecht, can you just comment on this small fiscal note that came into play?
Mr. Chair and members, what the fiscal note says is that the Department of Health receives federal funding for smoking-related activities, and that within that funding they would temporarily in fiscal years 15 and 16 divert resources to implementing and enforcing the provisions in this bill, and then those activity or those responsibilities would revert back to where they are. So it's reallocating money within the fund, and that's why it shows on the Department of Health page that the agency can absorb the $93,000 in 15 and the $42,000 in 16, and it's all within the federal fund.
Okay, thank you. So again, members, that's a relatively minor note, a fiscal note. Are there questions, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the fact that you don't want to have a great deal of discussion on this bill, and I agree with you. But this is the first time that I have seen this bill in committee, and I wonder if you would allow me to ask Senator Sharon one question.
Sure.
Senator Sharon, it looks as though what we're proposing to do is to treat e-cigarettes the same as tobacco products. So my question is, and I honestly don't know the answer to this question, is there a proposal here to tax e-cigarettes the same as we tax tobacco products?
The law currently does that. There's nothing in this bill that relates to the taxation of these products, but there is current law that does tax them the same.
Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, like some of the concerns I have relate, I think, specifically to Section 1, because I think we've been through this in the largest city I serve in St. Cloud, but I don't know all the details specifically. Can communities now, by ordinance, can an individual unit of government ban these devices from their buildings, so to speak?
Sure, sure.
Yes, they can, and several cities have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's the dilemma I think we have in St. Cloud. I think there's on a quick yellow page search, I think there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 or 20 stores that are selling these devices in St. Cloud alone, not to mention my whole district, and that's a continuing growing concern I have. I'm not sure that I'm quite willing yet to pull the rug out from under these storefronts that were quite frankly empty 12 and 24 months ago in some cases, when a municipality can step in and do this at the local level if their local elected officials can do so. So I appreciate that answer. Thanks.
Other Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for allowing this to come to the committee. This is my first look at it, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to at least familiarize myself a little bit. If I might, Senator Sharon, you started out your conversation by saying this has not been significantly researched and regulated. What conversations did you have in your Health and Human Services Committee that, with regards to, with that issue of the research and being regulated, what what kind of positive things did you have and what kind of negative things?
The commissioner of the Department of Health, and I think the assistant commissioner is here, probably can address that much more comprehensively than I can. But, you know, the discussion of the research in our committee, as has been the case in all of the committees, has been that the research is inadequate at this time to draw significant conclusions of what is the health risk related to e-cigarettes, and also whether or not the frequent anecdotal stories about it being a good nicotine cessation device to help people quit smoking. There's simply not been enough time to have the longitudinal studies to be able to know for certain what the outcomes may or may not be in terms of the positives or the negative benefits. And although there is growing body of evidence which describes what toxic substances are in the electronic cigarettes, some early research described about cellular change in relationship similar to tobacco smoking, but it's very preliminary and early toxic consequences of nicotine that have been reported to the Department of Health. There's a number of findings that are beginning to be presented, but they're all presented as early data and early findings on all sides in terms of whether or not there's a benefit, whether or not it's less problematic than cigarette smoking. That's what people are assuming is a likely outcome, but it is unknown at this time. And in part, Senator, the problem is that the product that's itself is has great deal of variations, and it's difficult to create longitudinal studies that do comparative studies on outcomes when the subject of the study has not been defined or regulated or contents described. That's the beginning place that has to occur in order for us to establish the kind of longitudinal studies that are necessary.
So thank you, Mr. So it's fair to say then that when you talk about comparisons with the regular tobacco cigarette, I guess you could say the same thing about alcohol. You know what you get when you buy a bottle of alcohol. You know what you get when you buy a can of beer. You know what you get with a cigarette, but we just simply don't know yet what this is going to be bringing forward. Is that fair?
Thank you, Senator Cohen. There are variations in the products. Some are these little kind of, and how they actually function. There's variations in what it is that's heating and emitting the vapor to be hailed. There's different types. Some are working towards trying to describe what's in it with some consistencies. Others are products where people can create their own capsule, I call it, of contents and have different levels of nicotine in them. So there's a variation. So when there's variation like that, it's very difficult until we get that regulated to do significant long-term studies.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if I could, just a couple more here real quickly. With regards to the bill, page 2, line 2.22, I can only guess what that product is about there.
What is that?
Could you explain what that is? Is that some kind of a device or nicotine or, I'm not going to try and pronounce the name, delivery product? Just never seen that before. Can you tell me what that is?
It's a tobacco burning.
Is it?
It's a tobacco burning. I'm just going to make certain. I think it does, in fact, have tobacco as a part of its product that it heats. But I'm just going to make sure.
Some other plant. I didn't
know. And while we're meeting, Mr. Chair, maybe you could just comment on prohibiting the sale of e-cigarettes to minors, vaping products. Is the bill real clear about that with regards to schools, limiting the use of vaping products in the schools, things like that?
Yes.
Do you think that's tightened up really, really well, I mean, compared to Google?
There's specific language prohibiting the sale in the schools.
Okay.
To your first question, it heats and creates a vapor from an herb that has tobacco-like qualities. It's different than the others that have a liquid. And Section 2, tobacco products prohibited in public schools. The purpose of this section is to prohibit the use of e-cigarettes in public schools by extending the prohibition in tobacco products to include e-cigarettes.
Thank you. Thank you. And just one more really small question, if you could, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You could even ask a slightly
a big
larger
one?
Question.
Bigger one?
No, a medium question.
With regards to that, the answer you gave me there with regards to the vegetable product, that's what I've been hearing is that, and put this to bed for me if you would, that cannabis could be used in there or any other product that is grown, any other vegetable matter, such as an herb. Is that possible?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, so in regards to, as I was looking through this closer, would this bill ban the shops that sell these devices from using that device in their shop in terms of a smoking lounge and that type
no.
of thing? It does not. Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Sir Lyles.
To Senator Ingebrigtsen's earlier question about the health effects, apparently in the New York Times in the last day or two was a report from the Journal of Nicotine and Tobacco Research that apparently some of the e-cigarettes that use particularly high temperatures, they're known as tank systems, they found that the fluids are producing formaldehyde. This is a peer-reviewed journal. And so the earlier research is starting to come in. Of course, formaldehyde is a carcinogen. It's also a byproduct of regular cigarettes. And apparently that journal Nicotine and Tobacco Research is also reviewing another study that has been submitted for publication that reaches the same conclusion, just to supplement the answer on the health effects.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to Senator Peterson's question or comments with regard to the storefronts in St. Cloud, because I read the letter to the editor from the Minnesota Retailers Association objecting to this bill because of their limiting the ability of retailers to sell their products. And so I combed through your bill, and I didn't find anywhere in the bill that really did that, because it looks to me like if you currently sell cigarettes, you can sell these things, and if you don't sell cigarettes, then you're limited in terms of where you have to place these so that minors don't have access to them. And so, Senator Peterson, if I could ask you, why do you think that this bill would hurt those retailers in your community?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoeff. Yeah, from my perspective, again, this is the first time I've seen this bill, and I'm not sure I'm willing to call this this activity smoking at this point and put it into that category when clearly the research has not determined that. At this point,
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I'm still just wanting to get to the exact question of those storefronts that you've mentioned that sell these e-cigarettes. Do they sell tobacco?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, the ones I visited, some do and some do not.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, so the ones that do not sell tobacco, they sell these in a place where they're just on shelves and young people could just purchase them. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, everyone I visited, the products are behind the counter.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, so that does seem to be what I've found too, so I still have yet to understand what the retailers' real concerns are. It seems that this is a pretty measured approach to these products. So I know we're just discussing the fiscal note, but I have appreciated the opportunity to go through and understand the policy, and it does seem like it's a prudent approach to a new product that does have the potential to harm particularly our young people. So thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I do appreciate this conversation. There is nothing in this bill that prohibits the sale of this product as it is now, excepting that it clearly states that it will not be sold to minors. And it doesn't prohibit people who choose to use this product to continue to use it if they are an adult, even though the product itself is uncertain as to whether or not it achieves the objective of helping people quit smoking, or even though it's unknown to the user as to the health risks that they engage in. And we know, as a matter of fact, in my own community, Mankato, in an article after the city of Mankato banned indoor air from vapor from indoor air, that the retailers there indicated it's not having an impact on their retail sales. So the use will continue, and people will be able to use it if they choose to. What the bill does, and this is simply in Article 1, the bill does define that where it has to be sold and attempts to do that to protect easy access to youth. But it certainly is available if people choose to use it. It doesn't prohibit that. It just asks that the risks that are unknown are not imposed on other people in public indoor places where the public would like the Freedom to Breathe Act to continue to extend to this product.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, I might suggest that we do open it up to some testimony, given that we are having some discussions about policy and there's questions about the bill, and I do think it would only be fair if there are people who want to testify, they would be offered the opportunity.
Well, Sarah Fishbach, the bill's been heard in several committees. It's basically a policy bill. You know, normally in Finance Committee we don't have full-scale testimony. Now, if there's somebody in particular you'd like to have testify, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, no, not necessarily. I just thought since there were questions that Senator Sharon didn't necessarily have complete answers to or had to ask someone else for answers, I was just in all fairness, you know, those folks that are potentially opposed to this bill should have the opportunity at least to make a case.
Well, Sarah Fishbach, nobody has called my office to request that they testify. I haven't seen anybody who's wanted to testify. So, Senator Peterson, did you have something?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Your hand up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just going to offer an oral amendment.
Okay, Senator Peterson.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, I would just offer an oral amendment to delete Section 1 and would ask for a roll call.
All right, we have Senator Peterson's motion in front of us. Delete Section 1.
Is that located on page 1?
Yep.
Yeah, Senator Peterson, do you
Mr. Chair, and senators, members of the committee, it really is, you can see Section 1 is basically putting this product into the category of tobacco. From my perspective, I have not been shown that, and I would just ask members to exercise some caution in terms of throwing it into that category at this point, would ask you to support that amendment.
Say it's not.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Sharon, you mentioned that the feedback or the experience in Mankato, so they had a local ban, I understand, on e-cigs being smoked or vaped or whatever you do with them indoors, and it did not harm the retailers. How many retailers roughly do you have in Mankato?
I can't answer that question, but I was referring to an article that was sent to me from the Free Press, which is our local newspaper, in which a retailer indicated that it had the restrictions had not impacted his business. But may I continue to say, this issue was reviewed in Commerce and passed through Commerce, and I think that in the same way that the other outcomes from research are unfounded in terms of determining either their strengths or limitations, my comment about retailers cannot be generalized. It's an anecdotal comment, and I wouldn't want to suggest in any way that that's a scientific study. But the discussion about its impact on the health of the public and their general desire to not share the risks, especially the unknown risks, is really the critical issue. It's not to do anything to stop adults who want to take these risks from doing that, but to not expose the general public from sharing that risk with them at this time.
But, Sir Miller, we actually have Senator Peterson's amendment.
Yep.
Is this to the amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Miller.
Because Section 1 is a pretty major part of the legislation, and Senator Sharon, this goes back to a previous comment that Senator Peterson had, and I do appreciate the information. I realize it's not scientific, but it is important to know that at least in one case that the retailer was not affected. And going back to Senator Bonoff's comments, I mean, my concern are our youth and the other people that are in these public environments. We don't know what the causes are, but going back to a question that Senator Peterson had, does anything in the bill directly change what the retailers are doing now as far as how they're selling the product in their stores? I'll admit I've never been into a store. I don't completely understand the whole retail environment for this product.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but Mr. Chair, I think there might be some folks that want to testify that may be able to help with this line of questioning about the actually have retail experience or retail information about the retail sales. And I believe Mr. O'Rourke would be able to answer some of the questions.
Okay. Mr. O'Rourke, did you?
That sell these products, you would have what you have your kind of sole vaping shops, which sell all vaping products and materials. There would be nothing that would change with regards to those stores. And then you also have shops that are that sell a mix of products. Gas stations would be a good example of this, but as more and more Minnesotans are choosing these products as an alternative to cigarettes, there are more stores that are trying to sell these products. And it may alter the way that they sell them. And the most significant point would be that they have to be kept behind the counter and locked up. And my clients fully support that. We comply with that right now under the way that they're working.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if you'll give me one. With regards to Senator Bonoff's question about the letter to the editor, the op-ed, wasn't actually related to this bill. There was a proposal in the other body that would have kind of made an uneven playing field and frankly would have actually favored the shops that I represent over the gas stations, and we opposed that. So that was the clarification on that.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question directly to Senator Peterson's amendment, and I'm wondering if probably Mr. Bodern would be the correct person to address this to. At least I hope so. Mr. Bodern, can you tell me what the legal effect of deleting Section 1 would be, and how does that relate to the Clean Indoor Air Act?
Mr. Bodern.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, I think there are quite a few people in here who probably know a lot more about this section than I do, but I think that's the primary effect, defining the use of e-cigarettes within this definition, or including e-cigarettes within this definition, subject e-cigarettes to the Clean Indoor Air Act. But I'm ready to be corrected on that.
That's fine. Now I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Potter.
Okay. Do we have further discussion on Senator Peterson's amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
If not, Senator Latz.
Two things. First of all, lest we fall into a trap of not considering this smoking, let's just consider the ad, which is in the materials that were handed out to this committee beforehand. There's a picture of an ad for Blue, which is owned by Lorillard, by the way, one of the largest traditional cigarette manufacturing companies in the world. And at the very top of the ad, it says, smoke in style with Blue electronic cigarettes. So apparently the industry considers this to be smoking. And the second point I'll make is that in terms of public support in that material also, there was a report of a poll that was done in January of this year, 2014. 79% of Minnesotans, according to this poll, support extending the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act to include electronic cigarettes. So if the public's opinion is of any value here, then we ought to factor that in deciding how to vote on this amendment.
So we have Senator Peterson's amendment. If there's no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll. The chairman votes no.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bonoff.
No.
Champion.
No.
Dibble.
No.
Fishbach.
Yes.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen. Yes. Latz.
No.
Limmer.
Yes.
Lori.
No.
Miller.
No.
Newman.
No.
Nino. Pappas.
No.
Peterson.
Yes.
Saxog.
Yes.
Sieben.
No.
Stumpf.
Yes.
Tomasoni.
Yes.
Westrom. Uyghur.
No.
Goodwin. Nino. Westrom.
On a vote of 8 yes, 11 no, the amendment fails. Further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 2027 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next we have Senator Dibble, Senate File 1641. Senator Lori moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Then we're going to have distributed members. In your packet, you've got the division report and the original bill, but we have a committee engrossment that we're going to distribute right now so we can work from one document. So let's wait for a second as people clear out and have a chance to get this engrossment distributed.
Sure.
Now it's showing the same.
So if everybody's got the CE1, this committee engrossment number one, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate your time and attention to this bill and this issue, which is, of course, coming a little late in the session. So I especially appreciate your time in light of that fact. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1641. Is a proposal to allow seriously ill patients whose doctors recommend medical cannabis to register for its use and safely access a limited amount of it. The conditions for which folks qualify for this access to cannabis are fairly tightly prescribed, and you can find those in the definitions section of debilitating medical conditions. There is an opportunity under prescribed circumstances through a procedure that's outlined in the bill to add to that list. The limited amount is no more than 2.5 ounces at a time. That's on par with most other states or quite a bit less than a number of them as well.
If a patient does qualify, they have to get an ID, a photo ID, with a number of security features on it from the Department of Health. And police and alternative treatment centers then can easily verify using a web-based verification system that the right person is obtaining access. The only certifying medical professionals, the folks who can prescribe, are doctors, medical doctors and doctors of osteopathy. If a minor is going to be able to gain access, they need a certification or prescription from two doctors, of course, their parent or their guardian's consent. And then the parent has to be in charge of picking up and, of course, handling the substance themselves. It does provide, the bill provides for some modest anti-discrimination protections for folks, unless it would be necessary under federal law for a federal contract, or, you know, in the case of employment, of course, that particular job is not compatible with use of cannabis. It provides for some defenses for folks who have medical cannabis so that they can stay within the bounds of law. I would note that the affirmative defense provision, which allowed for the gap in time before folks actually have a card issued to them to obtain access to medical cannabis, has been eliminated from the bill. Additionally, in the committee report that you adopted, the ability to smoke has been eliminated from the bill, and someone who comes from another state who otherwise qualifies, if they're just a visitor, would have no access to medical cannabis under the bill as it is in front of you. The places where folks would get the would obtain access would be at what we call alternative treatment centers, otherwise known as dispensaries. It'd be limited to a maximum of 55 in the state, and where they're located or the control on the number of where they're located is based on a per county basis and driven by the population in a given county. And there are further restrictions that local land use authorities can enact. Also within the rules that the Commissioner of Health is authorized to write, the Commissioner of Health can ensure that a number of other of these locational provisions are included. One thing that is built into the provision, the proposal in front of you, is that no alternative treatment centers can be within 1,000 feet of any school. But some of the details around locations, around signage, security, et cetera, with respect to the ATCs, is a function of the rules that the Commissioner of Health would write in conjunction with law enforcement and others. A patient can designate a caregiver to pick up cannabis on their behalf. They would also then need, of course, that registry card with some of the same standards around who they are and, you know, their background and their identifiers, et cetera. A patient can only designate one alternative treatment center from which to pick up medical cannabis. And there are fees that are charged. So the bill, and we'll have an amendment here in just a moment, the bill is self-supporting through the fees that are charged. In summary, the alternative treatment centers are charged on an annual basis $15,000 per year. Safety compliance facilities, otherwise known as labs, would be charged $5,000 per year. At present, we would ask for $100 per year from the patients with a lower amount for low-income folks. We're going to change that amount in just a minute, should an amendment that I propose be supported, up to $140 and $25 for low-income folks to $26 for low-income folks. And then a number of safeguards. There's an advisory council that's established. You can find that towards the back end of the bill with a number of representatives from the agencies, various agencies from the medical healthcare community, as well as folks who are familiar with lab procedures for testing of purity and content, et cetera. The council would make recommendations about these petitions for new conditions to be added to the list.
advise the commissioner on rules to be adopted, and take on an annual and semi-annual basis a fairly thorough analysis of the experience of the state with respect to a number of implications for this proposal, whether it's law enforcement or, you know, how many folks are using it, what the outcomes are, et cetera, et cetera. I think Senator Nenow might have an amendment. Is that true? To add to some of the assessment, or maybe Senator Bonoff is going to offer that. Okay. And there are a number of safeguards that are included, laboratory testing, labeling, making sure that there's good labeling, that folks know what the various cannabinoid strengths are, the various compounds that are useful to folks, et cetera. Very strict regulations that the health department can enact in rules for the alternative treatment centers, including governing, oversight, security, labeling, packaging, containers, signs, advertising, as I mentioned before, investigate complaints, perform inspections. Inspections can be performed at any time without any prior notice. Making sure that cannabis is only cultivated in enclosed, locked facilities that are registered with the health department, and that any cannabis is tracked with a very stringent tracking system from the point of planting and germination all the way to the point of consumption. Allows, of course, for a number of restrictions on the use, whether it's driving or in public, et cetera, consumption in the presence of a minor. And then quite a few restrictions around the diversion of cannabis for non-medical purposes, not only all the laws that already apply, but some additional sanctions up to felony sanctions, $3,000 fines and the like for any diversion, and also, of course, ejection from the ability to participate in the program. So with that, Mr. Chair, I can pause for questions, or I can offer the A44 amendment that deals with our desire to make sure that the bill has no implications for the general fund. All of the health department activities are covered by fees. Our goal is to make sure that any activities undertaken by the Department of Public Safety can also be covered by those fees.
Okay. Well, Senator Dibble, why don't we start with that amendment so that we know where we are in terms of the fiscal aspects of this bill. So let's have the amendment distributed. So, members, we have in front of us the fiscal note, which I believe represented, insofar as the general fund is concerned, an $873,000 expense. And I know, Senator Dibble, you and Senator Laurie, along with Mr. Naum and Mr. Albrecht, worked quite hard, and to be fair, at my request, to see if it was possible to do this without an implication for the general fund. Obviously, there's money spent in the bill that's non-general fund, and that's always been the case. But appreciate the work you did. So if we can have the A44 amendments being distributed, Senator Dibble, why don't you?
So, Mr. Chair, I'll move the A44, and what it does, Mr. Chair, in summary, is it raises the annual fee for qualifying patients, who hold the registry card, from $100 to $140. We do have a provision for low-income folks to pay $25. That would raise to $26. I was just about to do some math, but maybe Mr. Albrecht already has, but that raises, of course, quite a bit of additional money because I think they're projecting or forecasting about 35,000 patients in the state of Minnesota. Then in order to facilitate what would otherwise be special revenue funds that go into the special revenue fund in the Department of Health to get that money over to the Department of Public Safety. You can see in the latter part that interagency agreement needs to be executed for that purpose. And actually, I think it's $609,000. Either Mr. Albrecht or I think Chris Turner might be in the room who can help explain the Supreme Court costs. Don't need to be picked up. Oh, there he is. We need to make, there's this little technical piece on 1.6 to 1.7 to make sure that those special the funds in that special revenue fund that resides at the Department of Health can be used for public safety, Department of Public Safety. Then we pay for this annual assessment that we undertake as a part of the bill's activities.
Okay, so Mr. Ulbrich, do you want to comment on the integration of the two, the fiscal note we have and the A44 amendment?
I think Senator Dibble explained the way that this amendment addresses the costs, the $609,000 cost ongoing for the Public Safety Department. If you look on lines 1.15 to 1.18, it directs the Commissioner of Health to execute an interagency agreement with the Commissioner of Public Safety for their costs related to enforcing this bill. With respect to the overall fiscal note for the Department of Health, their costs are related to the variety of regulatory activities that they have, including, I believe the word is certifying, the alternative treatment facilities and issuing the cards to the individuals. There are also some costs, I believe, related to the safety compliance facilities as well. And all of those entities pay fees to cover the costs of the Department of Health's activities. And Mr. Greenman is here to answer any specific questions.
Okay. Mr. Turner, did you have anything to offer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, the $288,000 to the Supreme Court on the fiscal note represents a valuation that court administration made of increased appeals court hearing time. They are not requesting an appropriation. It doesn't rise to that level because the creation of a new appeals court panel would be well over $1 million.
All right. Further discussion on the A44 amendment. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this question would appropriately go to Mr. Turner. On the A44 amendment, line 10. Line 8. Looks like we're deleting $256,000 and $48,000 and inserting $3.5 million. Is that correct? Where is the money coming from and why the significant increase?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Albrecht.
Senator Newman. Senator Newman, I don't know where the original number came from. When I was doing this amendment, it looked to me like it must have been from last year at some point when this bill was introduced, I'm thinking. I'm guessing that as the bill has evolved, first of all, to specifically answer your question, this is the appropriation to the Commissioner of Health. And I am guessing that the scope of their responsibilities has increased since the bill was first introduced since the first time this number got in there. I really don't know the history of when the number got in there.
Sure, and I understand this has really been a moving target, just as a significant increase, maybe Senator Dibble has a comment on it. That would be fine. And then what are we going to use the $3.5 million for? Is the other part of my question, if you could.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
So probably the best thing, what we should have done is just have done a blank line appropriations when we introduced the bill, because I think we're just taking a kind of best guess stab at some costs based on the bill of now a number of years ago that passed, and this bill is different in its construction and conception than that bill. But the activities that this pays for, and keep in mind that they're paid for through the fees, so there's no general fund implication. But it's the ongoing at the outset, of course, the activities of undertaking all of the rulemaking and that sort of thing. So that's going to take some time and cost some money. And then, you know, on an ongoing basis, the Commissioner of Health is tasked with, you know, making sure that the alternative treatment centers are being run well, that, you know, that there's a, you know, a system in place. You know, the registry cards need to be issued and renewed on an annual basis, that there's a really solid tracking system in place for those and you know, making sure that there's good communication should someone's circumstances change for whatever reason, a patient's circumstances should change, either their doctor says they no longer benefit from this because their health has improved. So they need to shut off that card and make sure that everyone knows that card is no longer valid, or it's been lost or stolen, and so that card is no longer valid. A new card needs to be issued. So all of the provisions around making sure that the system is as tight as possible, making sure that there's a cannabis registry system, so that in fact, you know, we can track every plant from the time of being planted to the time of consumption, making sure that there's a robust inspections function, you know, so folks can drop in on an alternative treatment center at any time without announcement, take a look at the books, take a look at the facility, make sure it's secure and it's being run well and operated well. There's a whole background, you know, making sure that anyone who's running an alternative treatment center is of good character and good. I mean, there's just all kinds of activities that the Department of Health has to undertake to really keep a tight system around dispensing and access and tracking, investigating complaints, all of those sorts of things. You know, some of those can be. I mean, some of those can be read in the fiscal note. You know, some of it can be gleaned from the rulemaking section 4, which starts on the bottom of page 4 and runs through. 5 and 6. any other kind of major activities? So, Mr. Chair, I mean, most of it is just around making sure that we have a really solid, tight, secure system to really control and limit access.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so on the A44, the fiscal amendment, all those in favor signify by saying Sir Ingebrigtsen.
Sorry, I've had my hand up for a while, Mr. Chair. Senator, on the 35,000 patients, according to the fiscal note here, was taken from the Arizona plan, the Arizona. Can you explain to me the... we assume the first paragraph, Senator Dibble, under the qualifying patients and designated caregivers, the first paragraph, last sentence, where it talks about the percent of impact of qualified patients would actually go and be cut in half. Can you explain to me that last sentence?
I'm sorry, Senator Ingram, where are you looking?
Page 5 of 25 of the fiscal note.
And where on that page?
I'm sorry, under the qualifying patients and designated caregivers, top of the page, be the second paragraph, I guess it would be, under our assumptions. The reason, Mr. Chair, I'm asking that is the fees are certainly significant when you're talking 35,000 patients, and I was wondering where they had come up with that figure. That's the first time I've heard that, but this is the first time I heard the bill at all. So I was just wondering how we came about that. And it does say that at least half of, if we go to vaporizing, result in an additional 5% reduction in participation. Can you explain that to me?
It's not. Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman is here from the Department of Health, who can probably explain that assumption better than I can.
Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman, Budget Director with the Health Department. This assumption came from our agency. We, when the amendment went on in Health and Human Services Finance that prohibited smoking, we had to make an assumption about what impact that might have on enrollment in the program, because some people, I think, on the program would prefer to smoke the cannabis. What we assumed, we didn't have a lot of information going forward, so we had to make the best, most reasonable assumption we could come up with was that there would be some impact on enrollment. What we thought would happen is that the impact might affect 10% of the people on the program, and that about half of that half of those people would switch to vaporizing, and the other half would potentially just drop off the program.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that.
Senator,
the follow-up then, it's clear that some that can't get the satisfaction apparently other than smoking are going to drop out. Okay. Mr. Turner, Mr. Chair, you talked about the $288,000 that's just going to be absorbed. Is that what you're saying? You're telling me into the court system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, in talking with the court administrator, they estimate about 43 new appeals in 2015, and these are appeals of denials of either ID cards for users or permits for dispensers. They can appeal that to the, and it will be heard by the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and they estimate that time, which is actually translates into just a lengthening of the appeals court calendar. They want the legislature to know that this is a real activity, and so they value that at $288,000 the first year, and then $34,000 in subsequent years. And yes, the court said that they would absorb it because it doesn't rise to the level of creating a new appeals panel.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Turner, is the Court of Appeals the court of first jurisdiction then?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so, yes.
So thank you. And so follow up with that then, that hence the 2016 and 17 start here, because I understand that the permits will not be, I mean, sounds like they're going to be about a year down the line actually issuing those cards. Is that correct, Senator Dimmel?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And just a point of clarification, so before that, this is enacted immediately, before that one-year period, how again does the bill address the permission slips?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, those have been eliminated.
Those have been totally eliminated.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have further discussion on the A44, Senator Westrum?
Mr. Chair, related to the fiscal note, and the numbers, 35,000 potential users. I thought I heard a number from my constituent, and I'm not able to find the email quick and readily, but in Colorado, I thought she had told me that they've got 250 people using medical marijuana there. Your numbers of 35,000 seem to be a big difference. And do you have Senator Dibble or somebody that knows what would be the difference in the numbers, or what would they have been representing as 250 in Colorado? That's what my understanding was from my constituent who's actually out there with their child right now.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
Senator Westrum, 250 or 250,000?
250. And their point to me was that, I mean, there's limited use of this, but it's obviously for those that are in a very severe medical situation. But I can double check, but that's nothing you're familiar with.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, I can't give a good answer about the Colorado experience other than to mention that Colorado is a different situation, especially today, of course, because, you know, through referendum they approved wide access to marijuana for pretty much any reason. So it's probably hard at this point to distinguish between folks who are using it for the heck of it and those who are using it for a specific medical purpose. Our bill is drawn to pattern some of the best practices of a couple of states, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, spring to mind. Arizona actually has a slightly broader list of conditions for which people can access medical marijuana, but it's probably a good number to base, you know, to extrapolate ours on. So I'm not sure about the Colorado experience. I just can't speak to that. But, I think the fiscal note is drawn to the Arizona experience, and, of course, worth keeping in our mind the New Mexico and the Arizona experiences.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, you talked about the limit of 55 dispensaries based on population. And each dispensary is, am I right, they're paying $15,000 a license?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yeah, $15,000 per license for each dispensary,
and
each
so
alternative treatment center.
If we license 20, it's a big difference than 40 or 55. But mm-hmm. My question, two parts. How you mentioned that the locations of these would be based on population. Does that mean northwest Minnesota, western Minnesota, my district, some of the smallest counties in the state population-wise, not geographic, may be several counties away, might be half a state away, and most of them will be in the Twin Cities? And then who is likely, or what's the experience been with who pays for these licenses or becomes actively engaged in this business? Do you see mom and pop shops of the 55, or is it kind of a large business, national type businesses that come in and start running these? What's been the experience in other states, and is it who's kind of going to benefit from the dispensaries?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom. So the answer to your first question is which counties will have alternative treatment centers and on what basis. So in short, counties below 20,000 in population would qualify for none. Counties between 20,000 and 300,000 people would qualify for one. Counties between 300,000 people and 1 million people would qualify for two, and counties above 1 million would qualify for three. So that's how that would work. And so the answer to your question is probably yes. Folks who live in sparsely populated parts of the state would have quite a ways to go to find an alternative treatment center. In terms of who opens these up, I think it's a mixed experience in other places. I mean, I think there are some concerns that have, a number of these. I don't, I'm not familiar with them. You know, if they run a whole ton of them, but we do establish a fairly robust set of criteria. We establish this kind of numerically driven analysis that the commissioner can undertake to make sure that whoever is proposing to run an alternative treatment center has a number of qualifications, has a sound business proposal, and a really, really strong proposal that the commissioner analyzes against kind of a weighted numerical system. And the commissioner is empowered in conjunction with the advisory committee and whomever else he wants to consult with to establish what those factors are, including the factors that we, against which to score competing applicants, in addition to the ones that we establish in the bill itself. But we also allow the commissioner broad discretion to not approve alternative treatment center proposal. Maybe Ms. Ozzie can help me answer the question more specifically, if it's mom and pop shops or if it's larger businesses that open these up.
Okay. I'm Heather Ozzie. Director of Minnesotans for Compassionate Care. Chairman, members, yes, that's been the case. There have been a combination of mom-pop shops and larger organizations from other states that have been interested in entering the industry in all of the states that are recently developing these medical marijuana programs. The commissioner has had a huge amount of applicants in each of the other states competing for these applicants, and they've been selecting the best applicant based on a variety of qualifications.
Sarah Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you need someone to move the A44 amendment?
Well, Senator Dibble has done that. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, I too am just so surprised by that 35,000 number, and I wondered if Mr. Greenman, I didn't really get a full sense of where that came from. What is it that doctors who treat those types of illnesses, it's aggregated data, or is it how people expressed interest? And I'm just curious because it does seem way bigger than I would have thought.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think it's just simply extrapolated from other states' experience. You know, we have a population of 5 million, and I think Department of Health's analysis was that even though the Arizona conditions for which you can access medical marijuana are slightly broader, the population is a little bit older in Arizona, so as we know, because a lot of older Minnesotans are there. But the general population mix is similar, and so the conditions that folks would be experiencing would be similar. So they're just doing analysis based on extrapolating the experience of other states.
Okay, we've got Senator Dibble's motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, that's it for me. I'm willing to stand for questions or amendments. I think Senator Bonoff wanted to propose an idea that I'm aware of.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I actually now have two amendments.
All right.
I'll start with the A40. Maybe while they're working that out, I could offer the A45.
If we could have that distributed. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, I believe Senator Benson had discussed this with you. This is would develop a method to track the practitioners who are providing the written certifications to registered qualifying patients and the debilitating medical conditions that have been certified by these practitioners. Currently, included as part of the first assessment, there's a report required by the Commissioner of Health that's due February 15th. This just adds the requirement in that report to let you know exactly, you know, which practitioners are taking advantage of this and to get some understanding of the numbers with regard to the conditions so we have a better understanding.
Mr. Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, I think this is a good idea, a good proposal. I accept this amendment, encourage the committee's adoption of it. If you look at Section 21 assessment, it's kind of in keeping with the spirit. This was an idea that was originally brought by Senator Rosen, and we incorporated it into the bill. And this this activity falls under the responsibility of the task force or the, advisory council that you find earlier, page 21, section 20, the Medical Cannabis Advisory Council. So it's a good data set for us to keep track of.
All right, is there further discussion on the A45, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the amendment, Senator, do you know how many of these practitioners we're talking about in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, so these would be the, you know, doctors who choose to prescribe it, and I don't think we do have an idea, and that's why we want the information. We actually would want to know, you know, which doctors are choosing this. Senator Benson, as she told me an anecdote, she said in Arizona they actually found there was one practitioner who had, like, three-quarters of the prescriptions, and so in that case the medical board investigated that. So it just makes sure that there's some quality and assessment of that practice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I certainly appreciate that, and I agree with that. I think they should be monitored. But I'm wondering how many there are going to be in the state of Minnesota that are going to do this when not that long ago they came together as a group and said they weren't going to support this. So my guess is, and it's only a guess, practical with regards to a practical matter or a statement that, if it's not FDA approved, my guess is that there's not going to be a whole lot of practitioners that are going to participate. That's a concern of mine. If it's going to be one or two that are going to be able to do that, if it's not FDA approved, I wonder how many practitioners are really going to participate. So I certainly approve. I approve with the amendment. I think they should be certainly looked at. But do you have any ideas that other than just a guess?
Okay.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the amendment to Senator Ingebrigtsen's questions. The point here is to try to make sure that we don't get the Minnesota version of a Dr. Feelgood. But what Senator Ingebrigtsen said, there may be a small handful of practitioners across the state that are willing to step out into this. So the fact that a handful of practitioners are supplying the bulk of these, I guess we're calling them recommendations, not prescriptions, is not in and of itself a problem, but it merits somebody taking a look at to make sure that we don't have abusive activity or misuse by certain practitioners. So that's what this amendment is trying to get at. I've talked to Senator Benson about these things, and it's a good amendment, but it doesn't necessarily disqualify somebody just because they are doing a disproportionate share of the prescribing, even though it's not a prescription, it's a recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I just need to clarify for the record that the Minnesota Medical Association is neutral. The instance that Senator Ingebrigtsen cites was a survey of like 10 or so people in a room one day. A majority of docs in the country actually support a provision like this. So it's mixed in the medical establishment.
All right. We have Senator Bono's motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I now have the A40 that I would offer.
Could I have that distributed, please? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of conversation from the law enforcement community about the costs that they have projected they would incur were this to pass. And so what this amendment does is it asks the Commissioner of Public Safety to report to the chairs and ranking minority members having jurisdiction over this what the costs actually are, and then, in fact, to compare the cost to the estimated costs that were previously given.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I support this amendment. This has been the point of some discussion in previous committees brought forward in particular by Senator Sharon. I also know that as a function of the interagency agreement between the Department of Health and Department of Public Safety, I'm fairly certain through conversations with management and budget that Department of Health is going to require that the costs that are reimbursed to the Department of Public Safety out of the fees, out of the special revenue fund, be justified.
Okay.
And so it would be a specific amount. So this will be a figure that will be readily available to us for this purpose, and that will be interesting for us to know what the actual experience is relative to the estimate that showed up in the fiscal note.
Senator Engelbrightson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, just referring to the fiscal note, can you tell me what the potential cost could be to the Department of Public Safety? What was in there? I'm not exactly sure that. I know there was testimony earlier. I don't remember what committee it was. I was just sitting in on it. And they were talking about potential issues with regards to financial. And I'm wondering if they're in the room, if they'd like to weigh in on this amendment, Mr. Chair, if that would be permissible. I'm not sure if they are here.
So, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, if you look under net expenditures, general fund, so at the front of the fiscal note, the kind of the fourth row down, public safety was looking at $609,000 per year, kind of ongoing, and then they have a detail page further back that describes what that entails.
Further questions on the A40, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I don't know if this was your proposal or if someone brought this to you, but there was I sat in on all 5 hours of the Judiciary Committee, and this was a point of discussion, particularly I know for Senator Sharon, not relative to necessarily the Department of Public Safety, but the Department of Health. And the commentary that the fiscal note seems to be particularly robust on this particular
generous.
Yes, there you go. That's the word. And my question to you is, why just Department of Public Safety and not including Minnesota Department of Health on this? She had an interest, and I think the committee seemed to kind of agree, but they didn't have the language that they could put together at the time. That it would be good to come back and have an assessment of as to whether, because once this gets built in, it gets built in forever when we build these costs into these departments. And so that's my question. Why not add Department of Health in this, since that's where most of the money's going, actually?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino and Senator Dibble, I welcome your thoughts on this. Originally, this was brought to me via Senator Dibble, Senator Sharon, and it just had this, but then I did speak to Senator Benson about it, as she had a similar proposal that was directed to the Department or the Commission of Public Health. So as we discussed it, she looked at this, and we also looked at the provision that we just adopted with regard to the reporting of the practitioners themselves. Senator Benson suggested we leave it for now at this. If adding that is the will of the committee and the will of the author, then I'd be open to including language. Ms. Kavanaugh, who's not in the room right now, actually had that as part of proposed language.
Well, Mr. Chair, if the author of the amendment is amenable, I mean, I'd ask counsel if we could put together some language and just add the Department of Health in here. I mean, if we're going to do it for public safety, let's do it for health as well. I mean, if we're underfunding them, we should know that. And if we're being more generous than we need to, that would be helpful to know as well.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I'm agreeable to Senator Ninau's suggestion. I will say the conversation was focused on public safety and some of the claims made by the Department of Public Safety about the activities that they think they're going to undertake being a little bit overstated, particularly given that their analysis was based on the Hawaii and Oregon experience, which is very different than Minnesota's, and they even say within their own fiscal note that there's no good data coming out of Hawaii, Oregon, because they don't actually track their activities in the way that they're justifying then by the fiscal note that emerges. I'll also say that, with the amendments that were made in Senator Lori's committee, a lot of the public safety activities, visiting qualifying patients, elimination of preemption, affirmative defense, thank you, go a long way towards limiting public safety and law enforcement activities quite a bit. But it's a good idea. We should keep track of the money, and we should know if the fees that we're charging are justified or not. I suspect we'll show, even with the Department of Health activities that we undertake, quite a bit of surplus and over time, and maybe we can scale back the fees so they actually balance and we find that equilibrium that we should be finding when we're assessing fees for particular public services.
I think that was a yes, right, mm-hmm. Senator Dibble? Okay, so
I said yes at the top, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, just a question for Mr. Turner, too.
Well,
if the analysts are ready. Yeah.
No, from the exchange, let me ask Mr. Bodden if he has some language to suggest.
So, Mr. Chairman, some proposed language would be to add this to the direction that's given to the Commissioner of Health in the bill on page 22. There's a whole set of items. There are 8 separate items Commissioner of Health is required to report on, and this could be included within those and would become on page 22 after line 24 of the bill, a new clause 9, which would read the actual costs of implementing this act compared to the estimated cost. And then there are some technical changes just to include it within that list of clauses.
Sir Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Bodden, could we also include compared to the estimated costs? Did you say that?
Mr. Chair,
oh, I'm sorry. Okay,
yeah,
thank
that was
you.
Included.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so moved.
Okay, so you'd incorporate that in your amendment?
Yes, I would. Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Do we have further discussion then on the A40 amendment as with the incorporation of language suggested by counsel? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Further discussion or amendments? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Mr. Turner is up there, can you tell me what local impact this particular, probably should have asked that before, but what local impact this will have? This particular amendment that was just accepted, any local costs at all that would be considered at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, of course, the fiscal note before us addresses direct state costs. In the front of the Judiciary Committee, the Minnesota Association of Sheriffs, represented by Mr. Jim Franklin, testified at length on local costs that the bill would impose. But they're
not included in the fiscal note, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I asked that question when I was given the amendment and was told that the being asked for this data in this way, this is data that is being collected, so they felt as though aggregating the data that was already being collected would be a negligible addition to the local.
Mr. Expense. Chair, thank you. Thank you for that. It was not for the amendment. It was just an overall question for the fiscal note. I apologize for that.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dibble, in your opening remarks, you indicated that in the prior version, the aspect of visitors coming into the state of Minnesota has been removed mm-hmm. from the bill. So I've got two questions that I think are related. Number one, is there any residency requirement in your bill, or to phrase it a different way, can a qualifying patient be a non-resident? And then the second question is, if a
non-resident comes into the state of Minnesota that is qualified in a different state, would I be correct that that non-resident or that visitor coming into the state of Minnesota would be subject to our criminal penalties for possession and use of marijuana?
So, Mr. Chair, I would have to, you know, maybe Senator Nino knows my bill better than I do. But we have a.
And if you don't,
if we have a residency requirement, that's the intent, of course, Mr. Chair. To your second question, Senator Nino, anyone who comes into Minnesota, if they're not a resident of the state, and they're not a qualifying patient, cannot have any marijuana on their person, cannot use or possess any marijuana of any sort for any reason.
So. Yep. Further question, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go back to Senator Ingebrigtsen's comment, but to the question just asked, as I read the bill, I think you could be a non-Minnesota permanent resident residing in Minnesota, seeing a Minnesota doctor, getting a recommendation, and be able to utilize this. You could not be a you could not come in, for example, from California with a written recommendation from a doctor and purchase or possess as a result. So that may be a bit of a nuance, but that's the way that that was a change that was made in the HHS committee just late last week. Now, we used to have a non-resident provision in the bill. That has been removed, but I don't think there is a technical requirement that you be a permanent resident of Minnesota. You could be temporarily staying here for 5 months, see a doctor, get a recommendation, but you could not be an Arizona resident or a California resident or an Oregon resident with a letter from your doctor. That was in a previous version of the bill. To Senator Ingebrigtsen's question about local costs, both Senator Ingebrigtsen and I sat in on Judiciary Committee where there was a lot of discussion about that, and law enforcement had significant concerns about what they called unfunded mandate in the local costs because of necessary training, et cetera. To be fair to both sides, some of that probably still will exist as I understand it, but a lot of their concerns had to do with things like the non-residents coming in and how could they tell whether that letter from Dr. Johnson from California was legitimate or not, and whether that person that wasn't from Minnesota that had 2 ounces of cannabis was legal or not. A couple of major provisions in the bill that I actually had a lot of heartburn over were removed in the HHS committee. I sat in on a good portion of that. You might have noticed I missed a lot of the last finance committee because I was bouncing between and trying to track this particular bill. So a lot of those concerns were removed that Senator Ingebrigtsen is alluding to. But to be fair, there still will be some of that at the local level because there's going to be people that, if this becomes law, medically have been given the authority to possess cannabis, and local law enforcement will run across them on occasion. They're going to have to know how to deal with that. But with the smoking elimination and with the out-of-state provision removed, a lot of that has gone away. And I think a lot of the concerns for local law enforcement as far as their training needs, but not all, certainly not all.
Senator Dibble.
Maybe to answer your question of Senator Nino a little bit better. In order to qualify for access to cannabis, a patient, of course, would have to have the conditions that are described and have a full kind of doctor-patient relationship with a medically licensed doctor, and have a full, you know, examination analysis or whatever that entails. It's described in the bill, and then of course apply to the Commissioner of Health for the registry card, pay the $140, receive the card, you know, and then access the cannabis, at the alternative treatment center. All of that, of course, implies that that's someone who's here for some period of time. Whether or not they've established residency, they're here, and they're entering into a relationship with a doctor, entering a relationship with a specific alternative treatment center. Of course, having to provide quite a bit of information to the Commissioner of Health before they can qualify for the card. They can't take it across the state line, so they can't just like drop in, get what they need, and then then leave. They're breaking laws that we have no control over in that instance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Right. Further to Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to storing on your first page, Senator, and you talk about fees, and that's what we're here to talk about is the financial aspects. Is there a limit to the storage, and is there an additional fee charge for a larger amount that's stored? Has that been addressed at all, or can you give the committee kind of an idea as to how much they can store or how many plants they can grow, that type of thing?
Well, Mr. Chair, no one can have any more than 2.5 ounces at any one time, so that there will be no storage of anything in excess of 2.5 ounces.
That would be the patient, but the dispensary storage. Nobody, they can't have more than 2.5 ounces.
Mr. Chair, I thought Senator Ingram, you were talking about an individual.
No.
The bill doesn't address how much a dispensary can have on hand at any one time. And, of course, just for the record, no individual can grow.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's any limitation on how much a dispensary themselves can grow. it does have to be secure, locked facility with, you know, all kinds of other measures to make sure it's very, very secure. And then each plant, of course, needs to be specifically tracked.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up with that, Senator, when we talk about the cannabis, and I know we're getting into some areas, I'm sure you've been asked this question because you've been asked every question. The product that was in the 60s is now obviously different than what was raised in the 60s versus now the potency. Do we have any quantitative way of measuring that? Like we do know what a FDA-approved pill is going to do to a patient generally. I mean, we also know, the other myth, which is alcohol and tobacco, we know what they do to people. Do we have any quantitative measurement on? You have 55 different dispensaries throughout the state. Is there going to be one that's going to have stronger, more potent, as you call it, medication? Or can you give me a flavor of that? And again, is that fee-based too? I mean, does it cost more money to raise a stronger, more potent plant than the other?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, so the answer to your question is that I'm certain that alternative treatment centers are going to have a wide variety of options that are available to patients, because patients with different conditions need different things, and they need to, of course, ingest cannabis in different ways, whether it's topical or pill or oil or vaporizing, what have you. And they need cannabis that have different compounds with different strengths. And in answer to your question, there are many different strains of cannabis, and they have different balances of CBD versus THC and a number of other compounds that are present in cannabis. The best example, of course, is Charlotte's Web, which is an oil-based application. And it's very low in THC, very high in CBD, and it has, this very, very dramatic positive effect on children with seizure disorders. Other folks will need different balances and different strengths of those compounds. If you look at Subdivision 17, the Safety Compliance Facility, that's an entity to provide consumer protection services by means of laboratory sampling and testing for potency, contaminants, et cetera, making sure that there's safe and efficient packaging, labeling, and distribution, there's security and inventory accountability procedures, and that they're dispensing scientific and medical research findings related to cannabis. And I'll also add that the Advisory Council, towards the back of the bill, we placed on that someone who has expertise in these activities. And we heard, of course, quite a bit of testimony from Mr. Stubbs, who talked quite a bit about the fact that you can evaluate cannabis quite precisely for the different strengths and potencies and purities that's, and then that needs to be labeled and communicated well so folks know what they're getting in conversation with their doctor.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator, so there is going to be at least a menu then, so to speak, I guess you'd probably, for better lack of a better term, a menu for a physician to actually go to and say 1 through 10, mm-hmm. 1 through 10 of potency or different brands, different strains. There will be an actual registration at these particular dispensary sites of a menu, and the doctor will be able to write that prescription for that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, absolutely yes. And of course, there is emerging research, so we have some knowledge. I shared at one committee meeting some of the guidance that's starting to emerge that is on the Mayo Clinic website, for example.
Is it? And to that point, is it your you said later earlier that the medical community is on board with this? Do you have any idea how many doctors in the state of Minnesota will participate in this?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it would be generous to say the medical community is on board, but I'd say a majority of docs, at least polled nationally, are in favor. I just don't know the answer to the second part. It remains to be seen, but there will be a lot. There will be quite a few. We've had a number of step forward to indicate their interest in having this opportunity with their patients because they have no way to provide anything else to them.
Somebody else had a hand up, otherwise.
Sarah Westrom did.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I assume the summary is close in line with the bill. It does provide that a county over 5,000 square miles could have a second dispensary. How many counties meet that criteria, do you know, or is that just St. Louis County or Otterdale County?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I believe that provision was to capture St. Louis County. I think it was over 5,000, but a particular population, I can't remember what the...
Big Stone County and several counties in western Minnesota, your earlier answer indicated under 20,000 cannot have a dispensary.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that's correct.
So most of western Minnesota counties would not be eligible to qualify for this. Is there a reason we don't want to allow them in a small county and other people can drive?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I'll have Ms. Ozzie help me answer the question. She was instrumental in helping write a lot of the provisions. Part of what we're trying to do, of course, part of what we're trying to accomplish is to not have a dispensary on every corner. That seemed to be a concern about what was going on in some other states. We're trying to find some mechanism to limit the establishment of dispensaries, so that. That's a key feature of complaint that comes out of, for example, California. So, Ms. Ozzie.
Mr. Chair, Senator, members, I do believe that the 35,000 patient estimate is highly inflated here. For example, it's based on some other states that have much broader conditions. I think we're going to see significantly fewer patients in Minnesota. When counties have, only 20,000 residents in them, there are going to be very few qualifying patients in those counties. Probably not enough to actually sustain the operation of one of these dispensaries or alternative treatment centers. If you notice, the provisions of the bill do provide, they allow a caregiver of a patient who is registered with the Commissioner of Health to pick up and deliver the medicine to those patients.
Up to five patients, correct?
Yes. Hopefully that helps to mitigate some of the concern.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, I understand, I share the concern. I'm not even sure where I'm going to go on this bill yet. I've been no, and I'm, trying to approach it with the most open mind that I can, and as we do with all issues. But I also know if it's going to happen, I want to represent seven of my eight counties, so certainly wouldn't make that criteria, and I know Senator Dames and Coonan and Stumpf would have very few counties that would qualify with big districts and long ways to travel. And so I just asked that question with mixed feelings, but knowing my county, Big Stone, has a fairly high-profile scenario or case of a family that's separated or split because of Colorado law. And I guess that gets to my next question. It didn't look like the word the diagnosis epilepsy was in the definition of diseases. It had HIV, cancer. Is there a reason for that, or did I miss that somewhere?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, paragraph 2 of debilitating medical condition, you can see that starts on line 2.16. Some symptoms are listed, so it gets away from some specific diagnoses and gets into some symptom descriptions, and you can see the inclusion of seizures, including those characteristic of epilepsy. So rather than a specific epilepsy diagnosis, the symptoms that are consistent with epilepsy, because we know some of these seizure disorders aren't epilepsy, aren't named epilepsy, but have other names for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, if we need to put an alternative treatment center in your county to get your vote, we can do that. No, seriously, Mr. Chair, I mean, we can come up with some ideas like, aggregating counties together, on a population basis that have sparser population for the purpose of putting an alternative treatment center, for example, down in southwestern Minnesota. That's actually a good idea.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question comes or is directed toward the A45 amendment that we passed earlier. I was not in the room. This was regarding developing a method to track practitioners who provide written certifications. And I was just wondering if there was any discussion regarding a number of data privacy issues that would be triggered by this amendment while I was not here. Namely, there's no reference to protecting the individual patient identifier information on this amendment. I'm assuming it would be, but there's no references to either State Statute 144, which is on our medical privacy data, or Chapter 13. And I wouldn't dare want to just pinpoint a particular statute right now for it, but perhaps as this bill progresses to the floor, we may want to at least put it under those parameters. The questions I would have would be who would have access to this information other than the panel advisory council would have it? Would they have the authority to share this information with anyone? Or is this just regards to summary data? I see that the amendment itself makes reference to track practitioners who are providing certain certifications to registered qualifying patients. And I don't know if this is summary data or would it be very specific. Without definition, I think it could be anything. And so I would hope that we'd follow the tradition in Minnesota that we would protect this information, especially on individual identifiers.
Were you directing a question to Senator Dibble?
Well, I don't know who authored the amendment. I wasn't here at the time.
Senator Bonhoeff did.
Oh, she did. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, your points are well taken. When I offered this amendment, I was thinking of it as summary data and not connected to individual identifiers, but I would ask council before it gets to its next stop to look at that and see whether or not it should reference privacy data, because we certainly don't want to have anything in here conflict with our commitment to protect patient privacy.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out Senator Limmer in the committee, Section 14, which starts on line on page 13, line 23, where we do attempt to deal with some of the data practices. We may not have fully captured your concerns, but that's probably the place where we can do that, where we can do so. And it's a good suggestion, and so we should take a look at Section 14 with those suggestions in mind.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
And Senator Dibble, I see on lines 13.26 we're making reference to Chapter 13. I do know there may be some other references on medical data or health data in Statute 144, roughly. And we may want to just examine that before you get to the final stage.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to Senator Westrom's comments with regard to areas that might not be served. And I wonder if Senator Dibble might give some thought to having a process by which a local jurisdiction could request to be to have an alternative treatment facility.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that's a good suggestion. The other avenue to take, though, is to let the market kind of figure that out. So to create some ability, I think the aggregating, some counties together on a population basis or something like that. We did have a provision that would have allowed the commissioner in his discretion to approve an alternative treatment center, but then we subjected it to a number of the conditions that had already been established, so they kind of knocked out that locational piece. So we could create an exception or create an ability for the commissioner to take a look at an underserved area for the purpose of approving an alternative treatment center.
Do we have further discussion? Oh, Mr. Byron, you had a technical amendment you needed to suggest.
So, Mr. Chairman, this would just provide a little bit of clarification on the exact amount of some renewal fees. Take me a moment to find that. On page 8 in subdivision 6, this talks about the registration fees for medical cannabis organizations, and there's Subdivision 6 provides a direction for the renewal process. So I think on page 8, line 6, after fee, if you insert, comma, equivalent to the application fee required under Subdivision 1, that should take care of the exact amount of the renewal fee that would be required.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair.
So Senator Dibble makes that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion. If Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, in the bill you've shown some concern for public or private schools. I wonder if you'd comment on that. And I'm wondering, first of all, if you'd comment on that, and I'm wondering if there's other areas of our public that you'd be concerned about or be open to restricting the same type of language. First of all, could you comment on the public or private schools?
Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, I think the reason for that is just to be sensitive to some folks' sensibilities. I am actually not concerned about the impact or the implication of an alternative treatment center located anywhere, because I think they've been shown to be not problematic where they're, in those states that have safeguards and protections, some measures that allow for restriction of signage and, that sort of thing. And I'm certainly not concerned about the kinds of people who will be going there or even, any crime that's associated in the vicinity, because I think there really is none that's been shown. But nevertheless, some people are concerned And so I think that was just a bow to some folks' sensitivities. I think, though, that, you know, I mean, if there's some other sort of a use that you think to which you have some sensibility issues, I'm totally open to that conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator, for that answer. Yes, I am very concerned about that. I'm very concerned about the children having access, and even though it isn't statute, they don't have access. Recent articles showed in a state that supposedly has safeguards and protections, and that's Colorado, that we actually have now a fourth grader that's actually distributing or selling cannabis in the school grounds. And if that isn't concerning enough, I really, frankly, don't know what. And I know you've addressed that certainly with public and private schools. And I'd like to put it a little bit further, actually. And I'm going to offer the A32 amendment, Mr. Chair, and have folks take a look at that as well.
Okay, if we could have that distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence, by the way. I know this is not a fiscal issue, but I don't think it'll take too long of a discussion. I know we're up against the deadline here.
Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This basically broadens the area in which these particular sale of this medication is allowed, not within certain boundaries of our communities. And if you look at it, you're going to see, other than the nursing home, obviously, it pertains to generally where large groups of children can congregate, and I think it's a reasonable approach. I don't think it's too restrictive. Once again, basically coming off of the author's own bill here, who is addressing the public and private, even though he said it's not an issue, it certainly is an issue with a lot of constituents of mine, as well as the folks that. I used to work for where I used to work in light of some of the things that are happening. So, Mr. Chair, I certainly stand for any questions, but Senator, I would appreciate you considering this and I'd like to hear what your comments are.
Senator Bull.
Mr. Chair, I'll just point out to the committee a couple of items that are already in the bill. So on page 12, section 10, which says that local land use authorities can enact reasonable zoning regulations that limit the use of land for alternative treatment centers as well as safety compliance centers. And also back in the criteria against which the location or the registration of the alternative treatment centers as well as the safety compliance facilities. And one of the analysis is the zoning restrictions and making sure that they're in compliance with the zoning restrictions of a local unit of government. Handout is coming around to you that shows some of the both anecdotal evidence as well as the research that shows there's not a lot of reason to be concerned about these facilities in our communities. If they're well-run, they're secure, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, so I would resist the A32 amendment only because I think the concern is exaggerated and overblown. I think they're perfectly fine within, if they're operated well. That being said, I don't think it would do the bill grievous damage if it were to go on. So, of course, I'll leave it to the judgment of the committee. I would be concerned only in the instance where we're creating restrictions that are so onerous that we can't place an alternative treatment center in a community at which one maybe could or should be located.
And I would point out, you know, we don't have a germaneness rule in committee. And Senator Ingebrigts, I'm not going to, obviously, I'm not going to stop you from offering the amendment, but it really is, I would suggest, pure policy without much fiscal relevance. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your indulgence on this. I know that this is a policy issue, and we're in a finance committee, but I would ask that Senator Dibble reconsider his opposition to the amendment for this reason. We're talking about a total of 55 sites in the state of Minnesota. It seems to me that there is a great deal of room within the state of Minnesota, if in doing so you accommodate Senator Ingebretson's request, I just don't see the harm. So I would ask Senator Dibble to reconsider Senator Ingebretson's amendment.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
So my I'm resisting the amendment. it's not full on position, but I'll just articulate my concern a little more clearly. When things like public parks are included, I just think about my own city of Minneapolis. We're pretty densely packed. There are parks every few blocks. You know, 1,000 feet. You know, that's, you know, you start going 1,000 feet in any direction from all the facilities listed, shopping mall, public park. We actually have a lot of churches, you know, in some neighborhoods, a church on every block. And so I get worried about completely eliminating the ability for one to be located.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Lats.
I'd like to know how one defines shopping mall and how one defines church.
Senator, is that directed toward?
I suppose the author of the amendment.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Or whoever else can answer the question.
Mr. Chair.
Is a little strip mall that has two retail outlets and a neighborhood corner considered a shopping mall, or does it have to be Ridgedale?
Senator,
and is church limited to any particular denomination, or is it intended to be a broader
terms.
You know, we can question, I guess, that all day long, what church one goes to, whether that's going to be accepted or not. I think the senator asking the question knows very well what a church is. I mean, it's defined in statute, I believe. I believe churches are defined in statute. Maybe not. Maybe I'm inaccurate in saying that, but I think in general belief of the general public that a church is a church. With regards to shopping malls, that might be a little bit open, but nevertheless, we also know that those are hangouts. We know that that's where kids a lot of times like to hang out and do what kids do. That hasn't changed actually, even since my day. Even as old as I am, we used to hang out in particular areas, and there were hangouts back that far. Not as far back as Senator Limmers, but nevertheless. So, and again, I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair, for this. But in consideration that the senator already had schools and public schools in here, I know that there was an issue. And as Senator Newman has, I think, quite clearly stated, 55 statewide, I think that's, quite frankly, if I'm of need of this, I'm going to find that. I'm going to know where they are, and I'm going to find that. I just think I think we're stepping into an area when we get close to where children could hang out or accumulate whatever number you want to use, whatever quantitation you want to use, public parks, daycare centers, obviously, beaches, things like that. I think it's very clear that some areas of the country that we're using to pass this bill in support of this bill are also having some troubles. And I'm very concerned about the kids being around in those particular areas. So with
well,
that,
Mr. Chair,
I would ask for a roll call vote. And we can
okay, we have Senator Ingebrigtsen's motion on the 832 amendment. If there's no further discussion, Senator Latz.
Just, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't being facetious in my question. I don't know if church is defined in statute or not. I don't know, if it includes synagogues and mosques or any other building in which any religious organization uses for regular services. So I don't know the answer to that question. Shopping malls, similarly, I don't know how that's defined. But it just seems to me that with this list, in any area of population, it's going to end up being a complete exclusion zone because you're never going to find any location that's not going to be within 1,000 feet of one of these entities. If we really believe in local control, I think this is the kind of thing where we ought to enable local units of government to determine their own mores and zoning considerations and making that determination themselves. So on this one, I'm going to vote for local control.
Sure. Right, we have Senator Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, ironically, Senator Dibble, maybe Big Stone County will be the place.
The only one, yeah.
Consider this a rural amendment, maybe.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to suggest an amendment to the amendment. And on line 1.3, strike the word church and replace with house of worship. Perhaps that might be a broader use of language that might be acceptable to some.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
I certainly would accept that.
All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen has incorporated the suggestion of Senator Limmer. Is there further discussion on the 832 amendment? If not, the clerk will take the roll. The chairman votes no.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bonoff.
No.
Champion.
No.
Dibble.
No.
Fishbach.
Yes.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Latz. Limmer.
Yes.
Lori.
No.
Miller.
Yes.
Newman.
Yes.
Nino.
Yes.
Pappas.
No.
Peterson.
Yes.
Saxog.
No.
Sieben.
No.
Stump.
Yes.
Tomasoni.
No.
Westrom. Yes. Uyghur.
No.
Goodwin.
A vote of 10 yes, 11 no, the amendment fails. Further discussion or amendments? Not seen any. Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1641 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Opposed.
You didn't vote. I don't believe you just voted on the amendment, not the amendment. Actually,
it's incorporated.
No, Senator Ingebrigtsen had incorporated the amendment.
Okay, thank you.
So let's go back on the motion that sent. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Could I ask for a recorded vote?
Certainly. Roll call has been requested.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
I just wanted to comment those in the audience who have been holding up their pictures. I just want to acknowledge that presence and that we do appreciate and understand why they've done that. And okay, thank them
you.
For being here.
All right. We have Senator Dibble's motion that Senate File 1641 as amended be recommended to pass with a request for a roll call. Clerk will take the roll. Chairman votes yes.
Anderson.
No.
Bonoff.
Yes.
Champion.
Yes.
Dibble.
Yes.
Fishbach.
No.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Limmer.
No.
Lori.
Yes.